This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Tuesday, December 31st. I have here a list of recent articles by Ramesh Panuru from the conservative magazine National Review. Which one does not belong? How not to argue with Bill Barr. A New York Times article attacking Barr is not persuasive. Buttigieg's mandate is unneeded. We've now had a few years without Obamacare's individual mandate, and it doesn't look like the sky is falling. Democrats are flailing on the economy. And Trump meets the four tests for impeachment. Well, obviously, it's the last one that doesn't belong. Ramesh is critical of Democrats on most policy issues, but supports the removal of the president from office. Let's find out why and how this all fits together into a cohesive worldview, and maybe why more conservatives don't wind up with a similar mix. Ramesh Panuru is a senior editor for National Review, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, and a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Ramesh, we appreciate you making the time today. Happy New Year, and thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And I'm going to skip all the way to your fourth and final test. It's the one that you acknowledge has the strongest arguments against impeachment. And it's the question, is it prudent for Congress to remove him? And could it wind up doing more harm than good? So let's dive into those. How do you define or measure the word you use there, prudence?
Well, prudence is a tricky one to measure. But I think it really sort of gathers in all of the foreseeable consequences of alternative courses of action and an attempt to sort of to weigh them as best we can, given, of course, our limited knowledge of the future. It seems to me that as you said, the strongest arguments against removal are of this nature. There's not really, I think, a strong argument that the president didn't attempt to manipulate foreign policy in order to serve his political interests, for example. There's no strong argument that an abuse of power is not impeachable, right? I mean, there have been attempts to say, well, it has to be, you have to violate a statute in order to have committed an impeachable offense. But there's really no good reason for thinking that if you look at the constitutional language or history. So it finally comes down to this question of, well, maybe he did something impeachable, but we've got an election coming up. Why not just leave it there, especially since it's so bitterly divisive to impeach a president? And it seems to me that ultimately these arguments are not persuasive either. That in fact, if you've got the necessary political support to remove a president, if you've got the two-thirds majority in the Senate, then there's no real reason to worry about divisiveness and bitterness and so forth, since you've already got a national consensus that's pretty strong on the removal of a president. And if you don't have that degree of consensus, well, then you can't remove him. And the question then becomes, is it better to have more congressmen and senators saying this is unacceptable behavior? And there, I think it seems to me, again, the answer is yes.
We've had several other guests on from conservative media who I would say are not just apologists for Trump, who believe he did shake down Ukraine, but ultimately conclude that it's not a serious enough transgression to result in removal from office. One of them argued that basically no harm, no foul. The military aid was restored after just 84 days. Russia did not seize any more of Ukraine in that time. Zelensky was given a meeting with the president, just not at the White House. And overall, the Trump administration has approved lethal aid to Ukraine that Obama was opposed to and never did approve. What about the no harm, no foul argument?
Well, I mean, it's like saying that the Watergate burglary did not lead to any political information that the Nixon administration was able to use against the Democrats, and therefore it was okay. I think, look, it would be perfectly reasonable to say actual success in a corrupt plot is worse than failure in a corrupt plot. But particularly when the plot is not apologized for or regretted or apparently even understood to be wrong on the part of the president, I think that's a pretty bad thing still.
Let's take a phone call. Ron, you're on with Ramesh Panuro from National Review. Ron, thanks so much for calling in. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm an independent, but my thinking is this. I think that if they release the transcripts of the prior president and the president before him, and those transcripts were allowed to be read, that you would find, transcripts of the phone calls between the prior president and the president before him, between him, those presidents, and other leaders of foreign countries, that mm-hmm. they would be able to find mm-hmm. a tremendous amount of things that are way worse than what was on the transcript that President Trump released. And that I think, and I feel, that they're just being very picky. In other words, they're almost being like the thought police. In other words, he felt or he thought, but nothing actually materially happened. And I think that trying to impeach the president because of these reasons, it's just crazy.
Ron, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it. He's arguing that we can't judge the Trump phone call with Zelensky out of context unless we know what other recent presidents have said and other phone calls to other heads of state. What about that thought?
Well, we know that other presidents have not had conversations, or at least we've gotten no evidence that other presidents have had conversations with foreign leaders that caused the kind of panic and tumult inside their own administrations that this one caused in the Trump administration, that this course of policy caused in the Trump administration. If you've got an Obama national security advisor, that is a national security advisor chosen by Obama himself or by George W. Bush or Bill Clinton, likening some presidential course of action to a drug deal, which is the way John Bolton reportedly characterized the president's Ukrainian policy, then I think we'd have enough grounds to start asking questions and maybe we'd find out more things that were problematic on the part of those administrations. But there's a lot of reasons to think this is a pretty unusual situation. And certainly it's a situation that a lot of the foreign policy hands in the administration, including direct appointees of the president himself, thought was really problematic.
Do you think as a conservative, correct me if you don't identify yourself that way, but if you do you think as a conservative, your arguments for impeachment and removal are any different from how a liberal or a progressive would wind up in that camp?
No, I don't think that they're that different. You know, what is interesting is that in a way, everybody becomes an originalist on constitutional matters. When you're talking about impeachment, there's a lot of resort to, well, how did the founders understand this topic? What was the debate like? From liberals who don't always practice that method of figuring out what the Constitution means. And, you know, these things do tend to switch sides based on sort of the pure party politics of it. So, I mean, the kind of analysis I've undertaken is not that different from what conservatives used during the Clinton administration during the attempt to impeach Bill Clinton. I mean, the understanding of what an impeachable offense is, for example, is pretty much the same one that conservatives advocated back then, but that conservatives since then, you know, under Trump, are looking for a narrower view of what an impeachable offense is. And I don't, by the way, think that that's just a matter of people being kind of partisan hacks and being insincere in their arguments. I just think that the bias for and against one party or the other colors people's reasoning.
Vesna in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Vesna.
Hi, good morning. New Year.
Happy New Year.
I'm first very, very sad to listen that because of one corrupted country, half of political establishment is ready to remove president. it makes me very sad as a citizen to see that. But then I recall, and I have this question, maybe your guest will elaborate better way, that Mr. Obama withhold, I believe, hundreds of millions of dollars to Egypt with a reason, and also to many African countries demanding they accept situation with gays and lesbians. I've never heard for all these months of terror politicians imposed on us, ordinary people, to listen to this meaningless, disgusting game of power that somebody mentioned that about Mr. Obama. I would like to hear what your guest is saying about that.
Vesna, let me ask you a follow-up question, though, first. If he was withholding U.S. aid or conditioning U.S. aid on certain what he considered human rights policies toward gays and lesbians, you can agree or disagree with the policy, but that's a policy argument that the Obama administration thought was in the interest of the people of the world, which people is very different from asking for a favor for your reelection campaign to smear one of your rivals, right?
No, I don't see any difference. I don't see any difference, and
why?
I don't think he did in first place. Why would president ask such a new president for something like that? He can't provide, he won't provide, the country is more than corrupted. And if the country is not close to Russia, to have that important spot, nobody will even know that they exist.
Vesna, thank you so much for your call. Ramesh, I think it's a fascinating window into the minds of people who are not convinced that the president did anything wrong or anything worse than any other president that we've had from these past two callers. What are you thinking about any of the things that Vesna brought up? And I know there were several.
So, you know, there are ways. So the aid to Ukraine, for example, the administration could have held that up if, for example, the Pentagon had not certified that the government of Ukraine was taking steps against corruption, right? The law allowed for it to be held up. But the Pentagon certified that it was taking steps against corruption. And so that's the problem here, that you've got the defiance of a law. Look, it's not unusual for the law to allow the executive branch to make determinations that allow it to withhold aid or to dispense aid. There are often waivers. And if the Congress has given the president that discretion, and the president then exercises that discretion, that's one thing. This is a different kind of case. This is a case where the executive branch says, makes the determinations officially that everything is in place for the aid to be dispensed, and then doesn't dispense the aid and provides significant evidence that the reason that the aid isn't being provided is for the president's domestic political interests.
You know, to Democrats, and I'm sure a lot of Democratic Party leaning and progressive leaning, liberal leaning people are like throwing things at their radios right now, driving off the road. Please, people, don't drive off the road. Hearing somebody call in and say things like, this is the moral equivalent of withholding money for a policy reason, or what he did with Ukraine just wasn't a big deal. And I think to Democrats, one of the most concerning things about the whole Trump era so far is the amount of self-dealing and racism and flat-out lying in the face of opposite facts and other authoritarian-style actions that he takes and still keeps 90% Republican support. And the concern is that Trump is just a symptom of that 40% of America, if that's the right number, that's actually for that behavior. And progressives didn't think it was that bad, you know, and a lot of ethnic minorities and other kinds of minorities who are now more afraid than they were before 2016 didn't think it was that bad. How do you see the solidity of Trump's support no matter what he does?
Well, I think that we are seeing polarization in action. And the fact that so many political combatants on both sides view American politics as a kind of war these days has made it harder for people to break their lines. The strong support for the president, I think, is simpler than a lot of people have made it sound. The fact is, on the issues that most concern Republican voters, the president has been an ally. He's done what Republican voters are wanting him to do, on whether it's on the right to life or on guns or on taxes or on regulation. There are certainly issues where the president has not acted the way previous Republican presidents have done. Certainly there are policy areas where that's true, such as trade. Trade is an issue where most voters just don't have strong views. Most Republican voters were not deeply invested in free trade and are not currently deeply invested in protectionism. But on the issues that people care about, the president's actually pretty careful to hew to a standard Republican line. And so he's got the support of his co-partisans in an extremely polarized era.
Let me raise one more thing before we run out of time that I'm actually surprised doesn't get more attention as maybe impeachable. And it's the way that he threatens people and threatens violence. Marie Yovanovitch, she's going to go through some things. Colonel Vindman, guilty of treason for speaking out against Trump's policy. And we know what we used to do with traitors. He tweeted something like that. If I'm impeached, there's going to be a new civil war capitalized, like the Civil War. And this weekend, retweeting the possible identity of the whistleblower, a kind of retaliation that the whistleblower law is supposed to protect people from their bosses with respect to, and he's the ultimate boss. And this could even put the person in physical danger. Do you care about that set of authoritarian-seeming or mafia boss-like-seeming language from a president of the United States?
Well, yes, I do. I think it is disturbing. I think it is, indicative of a mindset that you do not want in the Oval Office. I'm a little hesitant to use the authoritarian label on the president just because he's so unauthoritative. He has so little control of his own administration. So, I mean, maybe it's authoritarianism leavened by incompetence or unseriousness in a lot of cases. But yeah, I think that this is a problem. I think that these are all different aspects of a fundamental unfitness for office. Now, impeachable offenses, I think, do have a broad scope. In theory, certainly things that the president says on his Twitter feed could count or could accumulate in order to count. But of course, that's not the argument that congressional Democrats are making. And so it's not something that people, including me, have given enough sustained thought to.
Ramesh Panuro is a senior editor for National Review, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, and a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you so much for coming on with us. We'll talk to you next year.
You're welcome. Take care.
And Happy New Year, listeners, to all of you. This podcast is going to take the rest of the week off as our major holiday downtime. We'll see if McConnell and Pelosi and all of them do too. And either way, we will jump back in with both feet starting on Monday and follow the impeachment process and what it means through to its conclusion. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org.